Mr. Chairman, dear colleagues, thank you very much for the invitation. Pleasure to be here. My disclosures for you, and the focus for many of us and also for me is when I talk about rhythm control therapy on catheter ablation, a little bit on antiarrhythmic drugs, rate control perhaps, prevention of thromboembolism with oral anticoagulation. We heard a lot just a couple seconds ago, and there's certainly much less attention on primary and secondary prevention with risk factor management, lifestyle changes, and my topic will try to make a point on that. So looking on what I call the pathophysiological triangle in atrial fibrillation, we all agree that we have a substantial role of the triggers, substantial role of the fibrotic substrate, but they are also the modulators. And the modulators act via multiple potential mechanisms, and today I will focus a little bit on the cardiac risk factors, which is in my title, but they are also very different modulators like inflammation, cancer, surgery, and I will also try to come back to that. A couple years ago, we tried to summarize the role of obesity, which is in the focus of the discussion in these days, and it's really a statement now that the link of atrial fibrillation with obesity is increasingly clear. The mechanistic pathways are not so easy and are certainly multifactorial. Left atrial enlargement seems to play really a major role. If we correct for left atrial enlargement, the role of obesity gets really smaller. But there are other points like diastolic dysfunction, inflammation. The role of epicardial fat is clearly not fully elucidated. Paracrine effects are discussed. Of course, there's often a combination with other cardiac risk factors and perhaps even more. And this slide is also there to indicate the paramount importance of Presh Sanders. He and his group did an excellent job in elucidating the role of risk factors and especially obesity. And I will discuss in a little bit more detail two of the studies of Presh Sanders. One was on goal-directed weight management in an atrial fibrillation cohort, the Legacy study. 355 patients with atrial fibrillation body mass index at least 27. Were offered weight management. Group one lost more than 10%, and group two and three less. And the result is really striking. So that you have a substantially lower burden of AF if you are obese and get a weight loss of more than 10%. Also, of course, very important for us as interventional electrophysiologists is the role of risk factor reduction on outcome of ablation. This is the ARREST AF study, also from Adelaide, 150 patients with atrial fibrillation, with obesity, and at least one cardiac risk factor. Group one, aggressive risk factor management. Group two, control patients. Typically, I don't like the term aggressive in medical science. We shouldn't be aggressive, but this was really kind of aggressive risk factor management. They took care of diet, exercise, hypertension, sleep apnea, alcohol, tobacco, sex. So this was really like they had a sad life, these patients. but they did substantially better. They did substantially better with respect. Now it's your choice. Now it's your choice. But I will come back to that because that is not completely our experience. And discussion is also not clear. Ablation outcome could be worse in obese patients because the atria are more sick in obese patients. Ablation could also be worse because the atria are enlarged in obese patients, which makes catheter navigation more difficult, which is clear. The whole procedure is also more difficult in obese patients, starting from groin puncture to fluoro picture, etc. The sedation is substantially more difficult, so patients are not that easy to handle, perhaps also a combination. And it's our experience is indeed different. When we compare the role of risk factors versus fibrosis as predictors for ablation outcome, you see here that there's not a dramatic influence of the risk factors on ablation outcome in our experience. And obesity was certainly far from being statistically significant. In contrast, in our experience, all the parameters that indicate fibrosis are highly significant as predictors for ablation outcome. One of the differences is that our body mass, mean body mass index is 27, and in Prashchander's groups is 31. So the Australian community has issues with obesity more than my current Swiss population. So that is that can be one of the reasons for the difference. There's more and more agreement that atrial fibrosis is the pathophysiological key player of the AF substrate. And I highlighted that here on this slide, and there's no agreement where it comes from. It's now 7 years ago that I tried to make the point that in my analysis, it's more a specific disease, which I called fibrotic atrial cardiomyopathy. And for this talk here, I would like to strongly make the point that the modulators are not the main fibrosis makers, and I will try to make that point very clear, if I can. Chuck. This is an early study. This is we did in the late 90s. Ne? Ulrike is with us. Ne? You did a good job in the early days. Was a pleasure. And what I tried to show on this slide is that for the individual patient, you cannot predict the amount of fibrosis, whether the patient is in lone paroxysmal or lone persistent atrial fibrillation, whether he's in paroxysmal mitral valve disease or persistent mitral valve disease. There are patients with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation having enormous amounts of fibrosis, and patients with persistent atrial fibrillation with almost no detectable atrial fibrosis. And this was confirmed and extended 10 years later by a multi-center study who did the same, found the same non-existing correlation in persistent versus long-standing persistent atrial fibrillation. I give you some examples. This 72-year-old patient, persistent atrial fibrillation for 9 months with a couple of risk factors, including obesity. The voltage map shows fibrotic area anterior, but the rest was very, very normal. This is a matched patient with no risk factors at all, but the atrium is fibrotically destroyed. This is an example, was a nice patient, 60-year-old, paroxysmal AF, hypertension, diabetes, massive obesity, obstructive sleep apnea, alcohol consumption. He was smoking, was married, and had a girlfriend, but had a perfectly normal atrium, not a single abnormal electrogram. This is another patient with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, no risk factors at all in the fibrotically diseased atrium. This is, for time reasons, I go to a more systematic approach, which is given here in our paper 1.5 years ago, where we looked, where we compared the BIFA population. This is the fibrosis population where we did our fibrosis isolation concept and a reference group with no detectable fibrosis. And you see that the risk factors are not substantially different. This is now the comparison within the fibrosis group. On the left side, FACM 1 and 2, so the not so much fibrosis, and 3 and 4 towards fibrotically destroyed atria. And also there, you cannot really see a substantial difference. So the risk factors are not the main fibrosis makers. I would like to stress one point, the female, it is very clear that you find more female patients in the higher fibrosis areas. And one more also on the TIA that fits to the previous speaker. We found previous stroke, especially or in this series, small series, exclusively in the higher fibrosis area. Now, Dietmar could say this is voltage mapping. I don't care of voltage mapping, so I would like to give Dietmar some MRI data here. This is from Nasir Marouche's group, patients with non-lone atrial fibrillation. And when you see and compare age, hypertension, diabetes, heart failure, no detectable difference between the fibrosis levels. So also indicating that the risk factors obviously are not the main fibrosis makers. And if that is correct, then the non-lone AF patients should have the same distribution of UTA class 1, 2, 3, 4 with the lone atrial fibrillation group, and it could not have been more identical. So that is another hint that really the risk factors are not the main fibrosis makers. Now, Dietmar could say he does not like MRI. So then I could say, then let's look at autopsy data on fibrosis in atrial fibrillation. no correlation to age and risk factors. This is a nice autopsy study. Jan Ho from London is a senior author, and the conclusion was no correlation at all could be detected between patient age and increase in the extent of fibrosis, and very important, atrial samples taken from the age-matched AF-free patients contained, that's a citation, negligibly low amounts of fibrofatty tissue despite similar clinical profile. So CHA2DS2 score of more than 4, but no evidence of fibrosis if no atrial fibrillation. Now, Dietmar could, of course, say he does not believe in autopsy data, but then I can't help anymore. Wonderful. And Dietmar could, because he's smart, he could ask a smart question. Is a risk factor modulator enough to result in atrial fibrillation? And I like this study very much. It's just an example. Why do some patients after cardiac surgery get AF, but most do not? Nice small study, 45 patients having cardiac surgery without a history of atrial fibrillation. They took preoperative blood draw, serum markers for collagen, plus left and right atrial biopsies. 18 patients developed atrial fibrillation, and 36 patients remained in normal sinus rhythm. And the significant difference, the only significant difference, was left atrial fibrosis and zero markers for collagen were both significantly higher in patients who developed atrial fibrillation versus those who stayed in sinus rhythm. So the analysis now is, for me, it seemed clear. If we look at this chart, then we have a very acutely active strong modulator, cardiac surgery, but we must have a pre-existing subthreshold fibrotic atrial cardiomyopathy, and that then results in the first manifestation of F. This is my understanding. Cannot prove everything, but this is why we are here. We have to discuss things. And the same holds true for me for obesity. More than 90% of obese patients do not have atrial fibrillation. Even most of obese patients with body mass index beyond 40 don't have atrial fibrillation. So in my understanding, it's a combination of active modulator plus pre-existing subthreshold FACM, which make them come to atrial fibrillation. We have put that forward, or next step, a couple years ago already. Now we do that for 5 years. We ablate according to the substrate and don't take care about the risk factors or paroxysmal versus non-paroxysmal AF. So in other words, when we have a patient with persistent atrial fibrillation and whatever risk factor, but no signs of fibrosis as evidence from just 100 points with voltage mapping, we only do PV isolation. In contrast, when we have a patient with paroxysmal AF, and again, whatever constellation of risk factors, we do the PV isolation and add box isolation of fibrotic areas. What results do we get with that? And that is very important. So on the FACM zero, whatever risk factor, whether paroxysmal or persistent, we come up to 94% freedom, 12 months freedom from F with only 1.1 procedure per patient. So that is for us a strong predictor. So when I see a patient with FACM zero, whatever risk factor, whatever clinical type of atrial fibrillation, I know I get him to stable sinus rhythm with just the PVI. The results are a little worse still with FACM class 1, 2, 3, 4. We get up to 83% with 1.2 procedures per patient. We can differentiate that. Then we see that the lower classes, we also get to 93%, and we are struggling in these days more or less only with the strawberries who are fibrotically destroyed, more or less. So one sentence on primary prevention. This is in a way a great study. Bariatric surgery and the risk of new onset AF in Swedish obese patients, so really primary prevention, weight loss through bariatric surgery in patients with a body mass index of mean body mass index of 42, so really massively obese, but the results are impressive. Median follow-up of 20 years, the risk of developing atrial fibrillation was almost 30% lower in the surgery group versus the control group. Of course, the goal must be don't get to a body mass index of 40 and not to get a stomach bypass, ne? But still it is an important lesson. So I would like to summarize and conclude and come back to my question. Lifestyle change first or ablation first. It's a statement. There's clear evidence that in patients with massive obesity and moderate burden of AF, substantial weight loss will very likely result in lower burden of AF and perhaps even freedom of AF, which brings then the fibrotic disease to subthreshold again. So option one will be patients with symptomatic AF and metabolic syndrome should be advised to undergo lifestyle changes prior to scheduling ablation procedure. But most of these patients hate that. And the AF burden also in many patients may simply be too large to recommend such a strategy. Option two could be a reverse approach, ablation first with hopefully elimination or complete elimination of AF, allowing return to a more active lifestyle, resulting then in effective and long-lasting risk factor management. I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Very nice talk. The paper is open for discussion.
May I start with one question before the other think of questions? I loved your talk, and I expect it was like that. One question, these operative atrial fibrillation patients, you get AF during surgery or right after surgery, they usually have a fairly benign course in the long run. When they recover from surgery, I think they have a fairly benign course. That really contradicts your view a little bit, I think, or am I totally wrong?
You're totally wrong. You should never say the chairman is totally wrong. I would never do that. But the point is really I tried to make that in my schematic drawing where I said the situation is you have a subthreshold fibrosis and you have a very strong and active modulator. Mm-hmm. And this brings it to suprathreshold. If that active modulator is gone again and the substrate is stable, mm-hmm. he will stay subthreshold. But we do not have clear data on the progression of FACM. So in my publication you can read that it is a potentially progressive process. Mm-hmm. It is like with dilated cardiomyopathy. When you look at the voltage maps in dilated cardiomyopathy, you also have in most patients, you have just a rim of fibrosis, just very basal around mitral annulus, but it's progressive and extends even up to the apex. Mm-hmm. But you can also not predict which one will go and how fast. And it's the same with FACM. We don't have data on that.
So surgery is really a very strong module.
It is, cancer also. Yeah. I have a series of patients which I ablated for atrial fibrillation. They were doing fine for 5 to 10 years and then come back with recurrences and then I'm already afraid that they have cancer. And it's often the case. It's then a strong modulator which brings it back to suprathreshold.
An additional question as far as anticoagulation is concerned. So if a patient after surgery has atrial fibrillation, you must expect that he has also fibrotic problem. What about anticoagulation in the long run in this patient? Have you got a feeling, an idea? Data is not there.
So no data, and I don't do it. But to answer it from the other direction is when I have a patient with CHA2DS2 score of 0 or 1 but have a FACM 4, Then I go to oral anticoagulation, although the data are not really convincing yet. But it's my individual decision then.
Joseph first.
Nice and provocative talk as usual. But you did not mention hemodynamics, and we measure for a long time now pressure in the atrium, and we showed that if you have increased pressure either at baseline or during stress test with hand grip, you have much worse results of ablation, and these patients have also bigger atrium, and we still don't know if they have more fibrosis, because if you have low voltage, it doesn't mean that it's a fibrosis only. So it might be something else. So if you analyze these predictors of high pressure in atrium, obesity is one of them, but obviously only one of them. So I agree that some obese people, extremely obese, may not have atrial fibrillation, but they have higher risk. And age is another one, and obviously hypertension and diastolic dysfunction. So I think if you can modify these risk factors that decrease pressure in the atrium, you may prevent atrial fibrillation. So this is probably more complex than just obesity and some other risk factors.
Yeah. thank you, Josef. No, I agree on these points. We don't do a lot of hemodynamic measurements, and I'm happy to hear your results. There are several modulators, and how they act still is unclear. I agree on that. On the other hand, Josef, my voltage mapping is so predictive of ablation outcome that regardless, you know, I don't measure pressure, but obviously I will also have patients with elevated pressure or mildly elevated pressure. But when I see an FACM zero, I can almost guarantee I get him to sinus rhythm, whatever the risk factor or whatever what is. Né? So the predictive accuracy and the predictive value of this voltage map in my experience is really tremendous.
A short question regarding that topic. If you have a voltage mapping shows clear fibrosis in the left atrium, would you actually not to ablate the patient?
Yeah, that's a good point. When I have really a strawberry, which means it is massive plus diffuse, I do a PV isolation, and then I in most of the patients, I let the patients go, and I do not even do a second procedure. This is why I report relatively...
So you do the first, but not the second?
Yeah, not the second one, the first one is, and therefore my results are relatively good with a low procedure per patient. When you look in the literature for multiple procedures, you often see 1.6, 1.8 procedures per patient. I have only 1.1 or 1.2 because I stop earlier in the strawberry patients. And in other labs, they get a 6th ablation, 7th ablation, or 8th ablation. And that to me does not make sense.
Robert.
Thank you very much, Hans, for your very thoughtful and comprehensive lecture. I will try to make a very short extension of your data and your hypothesis, and I would like to ask you to comment on that. You have shown that the factors which determine CHAD's VAS score are not associated with the degree of fibrosis.
I say they are not the main fibrosis makers. I'm not saying they're doing nothing. They are not the main fibrosis drivers.
Okay, that would mean that to a certain extent that the fibrotic atrial cardiomyopathy is dissociated from the risk of stroke. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, honestly, I don't understand, Robert, no? Because I say pretty much the opposite. I say higher degree FACM makes a high risk of embolic stroke.
But on the other hand, the CHAD's VASC factors do not contribute too much to the fibrosis.
Yeah, it's an independent point, Robert. FACM process is an independent point for thromboembolic events, independent. And that also fits, this is our voltage data, it's also, Nasir Marouche has the same with MRI data. And by the way, on also coming where it comes from, there will be soon also data indicating that the genetic part of atrial fibrillation is the fibrosis. So that is also not surprising for me. I said that already in the 2012 publication. So I think the evidence is increasing that the primary fibrosis is an independent disease. Okay. And it is correlated with in our experience and also in the experience of Nasir Marouche with stroke. So independent from the cardiovascular
that's
factor.
The point. Yeah.
Independent.
Obesity is not reflected in any other risk factors.
That's right. We would need an additional factor, CHAD's fibrosis or something like that, probably. It's independent.
Yeah, what we do in clinical practice, even when after ablation, whether we should stop anticoagulation or not, we take the softer, not yet clear points like left atrial enlargement. So even if a patient has a CHAD's VAS score of zero, but a left atrium of 55, then I would rather continue with anticoagulation. And certainly the same if somebody is FACM class 4, I would also, I do that. I agree, I don't have enough data, but I do that.